Herschel found a country station out of Clanton and shook his head at the DJ's twangy and sophomoric comments. He had entered another world, one he left long ago and hoped to forget forever. He pitied all those friends who still lived in Ford County and would never leave. 2/3 of his senior class at Clanton High were still in the area, working in factories and driving trucks and cutting pulpwood. His 10-year reunion had so saddened him, he skipped the 20-year. After the first divorce, Herschel's mother fled the place and resettled in Memphis. After the second, Herschel's stepmother fled the place and settled in Jackson. Seth hung on to the home, along with the land around it. For this reason, Herschel was forced to revisit the nightmare of his childhood when he went to see Seth, something he had done only once a year until the cancer arrived. The house was a one-story, ranch-style, red brick structure set back from the county road and heavily shaded with thick oaks and elms. There was a long, open front lawn where Herschel had played as a child, but never with his father. They had never tossed a baseball or a football, never even set up a kid's soccer goal or played tackle football. As he turned into the driveway, he looked at the wide lawn and was once again surprised at how small it now seemed. He parked behind another car, one he did not recognize, one with Ford County license plates, and for a moment stared at the house. He had always assumed he would not be bothered by his father's death, though he had male friends who had warned him otherwise. You grow into an adult. You're trained to control your emotions. You don't hug your father because he's not the hugging type. You don't send gifts or letters. And when he's dead, you know you can easily survive without him. A little sadness at the funeral, maybe a tear or two, but within days the ordeal is over and you're back to your life, undamaged. And those male friends had kind things to say about their fathers. They had watched the old guys age and face death with little concern for the aftermath, and every one of them had been blindsided by grief. Herschel felt nothing, no sense of loss, no sadness at the closing of a chapter, no pity for a man so troubled he took his own life. He sat in his car and looked at the house and admitted to himself that he felt nothing for his father. Perhaps there was a trace of relief in that he was gone and his death meant one less complicating factor in Herschel's life. Perhaps. He walked to the front door, which was opening as he approached. Letty Lang was standing in the doorway, touching her eyes with a tissue.
"Hello, Mr. Hubbard," she said in a voice straining with emotion.
"Hello, Letty," he said, stopping on the rubber doormat lying on the concrete porch. Had he known her better, he might have stepped forward for a quick hug or some gesture of shared sympathy, but he couldn't force himself to do it. He had met her only 3 or 4 times and never properly. She was a housekeeper, and a black one, and as such was expected to stay in the shadows when the family was around.
"I'm so sorry," she said, backing away.
"So am I," Herschel said. He followed her inside through the den to the kitchen, where she pointed to a coffee pot and said,
"I just made this."
"Is that your car out there?" he asked.
"Yes, sir."
"Why did you park in the driveway? I thought you were supposed to park to the side over there next to Dad's pickup."
"I'm sorry. I just wasn't thinking. I go move it."
"No, forget it. Pour me some coffee. 2 sugars.
"Yes, sir."
"Where's Dad's car? The Cadillac?"
Letty carefully poured the coffee into a cup.
"The sheriff took it in. Supposed to bring it back today."
"Why'd they take the car?"
"You'll have to ask them."
Herschel pulled a chair from under the table, sat down, and cradled his cup. He took a sip, frowned, said,
"How'd you find out about Dad?"
Letty leaned against a counter and folded her arms across her chest. He quickly scanned her from head to toe. She was wearing the same white cotton dress she always wore, knee length, a bit tight around the waist, where she carried a few pounds, and very tight across her ample chest. She did not miss the look. She never missed them. At 47 years of age and after 5 childbirths, Letty Lang still managed to get some looks, but never from white men. She said,
"Calvin called me last night, told me what happened, asked me to open up the house this morning and wait for y'all."
"Do you have a key?"
"No, sir. Ain't never had a key. The house was unlocked."
"Who's Calvin?"
"White man who works here on the property. Said Mr. Seth called him yesterday morning, told him to meet him down to the bridge at 2 o'clock. Sure enough, there he was."
She stopped her narrative long enough to dab her eyes with the tissue. Herschel took another sip. "The sheriff said Dad left a note and some instructions."
"I ain't seen nothing like that, but Calvin saw it. Said Mr. Seth wrote he was taking his own life."
She began crying. Herschel listened for a while, and when she was quiet, he asked, "How long have you worked here, Letty?" She took a deep breath and wiped her cheeks.
"I don't know. About 3 years. I started 2 days a week cleaning, Monday and Wednesday. A few hours a day. Didn't take much because Mr. Seth lived alone, you know. And he was pretty neat for a man. Then he asked me to cook for him, and I was happy to do it. More hours. I'd cook a bunch of stuff and leave it on the stove or in the refrigerator. Then when he got sick, he asked me to come in every morning and take care of him. When the chemo was real bad, he stayed in bed pretty much all day and night."
"I thought he was paying a nurse."
Letty knew how little Mr. Herschel and Mrs. Defoe had seen of their father during his illness. Letty knew everything. They knew almost nothing. However, she would be respectful, as always.
"Yes, sir. He did for a while. Then it got to where he didn't like 'em. They were always changing nurses, and you didn't know who might show up."
"So you've been working here full-time for how long?"
"About a year."
"How much did Dad pay you?"
$5 an hour."
"Five? That seems kind of high for domestic help, doesn't it? I mean, well, I live in Memphis, a big city, and my mother pays her housekeeper $4.50 an hour."
Letty just nodded because she had no response. She could have added that Mr. Seth paid her in cash and often added a little extra and had loaned her $5,000 when her son got in trouble and went to prison. That loan had been forgiven only 4 days earlier. There was nothing in writing. Herschel sipped his coffee in disapproval. Letty stared at the floor. Out in the driveway, 2 car doors slammed. Ramona Hubbard Defoe was crying before she cleared the front door. She embraced her older brother on the porch, and he, to his credit, managed to seem sufficiently moved. Eyes tightly closed, lips pooched, forehead furrowed. A man in real misery. Ramona wailed in what seemed to be authentic pain, though Herschel had his doubts. Ramona moved on and was soon hugging Letty, as if the two were the natural-born children of the same kind and loving father. Herschel, meanwhile, was still on the porch and greeting Ramona's husband, a man he loathed, and the loathing was mutual. Ian Defoe was a preppy from a family of bankers down in Jackson, the capital, the largest city, home to at least half the assholes in Mississippi. The banks were long gone, belly up, but Ian would forever cling to the airs of a privileged boy. Even though he had married lower, and even though he was now hustling to make a buck like everyone else. As they shook hands politely, Herschel glanced over his shoulder to check out their vehicle. No surprise. A shiny, seemingly new white Mercedes sedan, the latest in a line of same. Thanks to Ramona's drinking and loose tongue,
Herschel knew that Dear Ian leased his cars for 36 months and turned them in early. The payments caused a bind on their finances, but that didn't matter. It was far more important for Mr. and Mrs. Defoe to be seen around North Jackson in a proper vehicle. They eventually gathered in the den and found seats. Letty served them coffee and colas, then dutifully slipped into the shadows, into the open door of a bedroom just down the hall, a spot she often occupied when she listened to Mr. Seth on the phone in the den. From there, she could hear everything. Ramona cried some more and went on about how unbelievable everything was. The men just listened, agreeing, occasionally uttering a syllable or two. They were soon interrupted by the ringing of the doorbell. Two ladies from the church arrived with a cake and a casserole, and they were not to be denied. Letty hustled around and took the food to the kitchen, and the ladies, without the benefit of an invitation, plopped down in the den and commenced trolling for gossip. They had seen their brother Seth just yesterday at church, and he had looked so good. They knew about the lung cancer and all, but heavens, he seemed to have conquered it. Herschel and the Defoes offered nothing. Letty listened from the shadows. The church ladies were about to burst with all manner of inquiries. How'd he do it? And did he leave a note? And who gets the money? And any chance of foul play? But it was painfully clear such nosiness would not be well received. After 20 minutes of near silence, they lost interest and began their goodbyes. 5 minutes after they left, the doorbell rang again. The driveway was being watched. The three cars were attracting attention.
"Get that, Letty," Herschel yelled from the den. "We're hiding in the kitchen."
It was the neighbor across the road with a lemon cake. Letty thanked her and explained that Mr. Seth's children were indeed there, but not taking company. The neighbor loitered for a while on the porch, desperate to get inside and stick her nose into the family's drama. But Letty politely blocked the door. After she finally left, Letty took the cake to the kitchen, where it sat untouched on the counter. At the kitchen table, it didn't take long to get down to business.
"Have you seen the will?"
Ramona asked, her eyes remarkably clear now and glowing with intrigue and suspicion.
"No," Herschel said. "Have you?"
"No. I was here a couple of months ago."
"It was July," Ian interrupted.
"Okay, July. And I tried to talk to Daddy about his will. He said some lawyers in Tupelo had written it and that we would be properly taken care of. But that was all. Did you ever talk to him about it?"
"No," Herschel admitted. "It just didn't feel right, you know. The old guy was dying of cancer and I'm asking about his will. I couldn't do it."
Letty was lurking in the hallway, in the shadows, catching every word.
"What about his assets?"
Ian asked in cold blood. He had good reason to be curious since most of his own assets were so heavily mortgaged. His company built low-end shopping centers and strip malls, every deal loaded with debt. He worked frantically to stay one step ahead of his lenders, but they were always howling. Herschel glared at his brother-in-law, the leech, but kept his cool. All three suspected trouble with Seth's estate, so there was no sense in rushing things. They would be at war soon enough. Herschel shrugged and said,
"Don't know. He was very secretive, as you've seen. This house, the 200 acres around it, the lumber yard up the road. But I don't know about his loans and such. We never talked business."
"You never talked about anything,"
Ramona shot across the table, then immediately took it back.
"I'm sorry, Herschel. Please."
But such a cheap shot from a sibling can never be left alone. Herschel sneered and said,
"Didn't realize you and the old man were so close."
Ian quickly changed the subject with,
"Does he have an office here, or a place he kept his personal papers? Come on, why can't we look around here? There's bound to be bank statements and land deeds and contracts. Hell, I bet there's even a copy of the will right here in the house.
Letty should know, Ramona said.
Let's not involve her, Herschel said. Did you know he was paying her $5 an hour, full time?
$5, Ian repeated.
What are we paying Bernice?
$3.50, Ramona said, for 20 hours.
We're paying 4.5 in Memphis, Herschel reported proudly, as if he and not his mother wrote the checks.
Why would an old tightwad like Seth pay so much for a housekeeper? Ramona mused, knowing there was no answer.
She'd better enjoy it, Herschel said. Her days are numbered.
So we're firing her? Ramona asked.
Immediately. We have no choice. You want to keep forking over that kind of money? Look, sis, here's the plan. We get through the funeral, tell Letty to get things in order, then cut her loose and lock up the house. We'll put it on the market next week and hope for the best. There's no reason for her to hang around at $5 an hour.
In the shadows, Letty dropped her head.
Maybe not so fast, Ian said politely. At some point, and soon, we'll see the will. In it, we'll find out who'll serve as the executor of the estate, probably one of you. It's usually the surviving spouse or one of the kids. The executor will run the estate according to the terms of the will. I know all that, Herschel said, though he really didn't. Because Ian dealt with lawyers daily, he often acted like the legal expert in the family, one of many reasons Herschel despised him.
I just can't believe he's dead, Ramona said, finding a tear to wipe.
Herschel glared at her and was tempted to lunge across the table for a backhand. To his knowledge, she made the trip to Ford County once a year, usually alone because Ian couldn't stand the place and Seth couldn't stand Ian. She would leave Jackson around 9 a.m., insist on meeting Seth for lunch at the same roadside barbecue hut 10 miles north of Clanton, then follow him home where she was usually bored by 2 p.m. and back on the road by 4. Her two children, both in middle school, private, had not seen their grandfather in years. For sure, Herschel could claim nothing closer, but then he wasn't sitting there crying fake tears and pretending to miss the old man. A loud knock at the door startled them. Two uniformed deputies had arrived. Herschel opened the door, invited them in. Awkward introductions were made at the refrigerator. The deputies removed their hats and shook hands. Marshal Prather said,
"Sorry to interrupt y'all, but me and Deputy Pirtle here were sent by Sheriff Walls, who, by the way, sends his deepest condolences. We brought back Mr. Hubbard's car."
He handed the keys to Herschel, who said,
"Thanks."
Deputy Pirtle pulled an envelope out of a pocket and said,
"This here's what Mr. Hubbard left right there on the kitchen table. We found it yesterday after we found him. Sheriff Walls made copies, but thinks the family needs to keep the originals."
He handed the envelope to Ramona, who was sniffling again. Everyone said thanks, and after another awkward round of nodding and handshaking, the deputies left. Ramona opened the envelope and pulled out two sheets of paper. The first was the note to Calvin in which Seth confirmed his death as a proper suicide. The second was addressed not to his children, but to whom it may concern. It read,
"Funeral instructions. I want a simple service at the Irish Road Christian Church on Tuesday, October 4th at 4 p.m. with Reverend Don McElwain presiding. I'd like for Mrs. Nora Baines to sing the Old Rugged Cross. I do not want anyone to attempt a eulogy. Can't imagine anyone wanting to. Other than that, Reverend McElwain can say whatever he wants, 30 minutes max. If any black people wish to attend my funeral, then they are to be admitted. If they are not admitted, then forget the whole service and put me in the ground. My pallbearers are Harvey Moss, Dwayne Thomas, Steve Holland, Billy Bowles, Mike Mills, and Walter Robinson. Burial instructions. I just bought a plot in the Irish Road Cemetery behind the church.
I've spoken with Mr. McGargle at the funeral home, and he's been paid for the casket. No vault. Immediately after the church service, I want a quick interment, 5 minutes max, then lower the casket. So long. See you on the other side. Seth Hubbard.
After they passed it around the kitchen table and observed a moment of silence, they poured more coffee. Herschel cut a thick slice of the lemon cake and declared it delicious. The Defoes declined.
"Looks like your father planned it all rather well," Ian observed as he read the instructions again. "Quick and simple."
Ramona blurted,
"We have to talk about foul play, don't we? It hasn't been mentioned yet, has it? Can we at least have the discussion? What if it wasn't a suicide? What if someone else did it and tried to cover it up? Do you really believe Daddy would kill himself?"
Herschel and Ian gawked at her as if she had just sprouted horns. They were both tempted to rebuke her, to taunt her stupidity, but nothing was said during a long, heavy pause. Herschel slowly took another bite of cake. Ian gently lifted the two sheets of paper and said,
"Dear, how can anyone possibly fake this? You can recognize Seth's handwriting from 10 yards away."
She was crying, wiping tears. Herschel added,
"I asked the sheriff about that, Mona, and he's certain it was a suicide."
I know, she mumbled between sobs.
Ian said, "Your father was dying of cancer, in a lot of pain and such, and he took matters into his own hands. Looks like he was pretty thorough."
"I can't believe it," she said. "Why couldn't he talk to us?"
"Because you people never talk to each other," Letty said to herself in the shadows.
Ian, the expert, said,
"This is not unusual in a suicide. They never talk to anyone, and they can go to great lengths to plan things. My uncle shot himself 2 years ago, and..."
"Your uncle was a drunk," Ramona said as she dried up.
"Yes, he was. And he was drunk when he shot himself, but he still managed to plan it all."
"Let's talk about something else, can we?" Herschel said.
"No, Mona. There was no foul play. Seth did it himself and left notes behind. I say we go through the house and look for papers, bank statements, maybe the will, anything that we might need to find. We're the family, and we're in charge now. Nothing wrong with that, right?"
Ian and Ramona were nodding yes. Letty was actually smiling. Mr. Seth had taken all his papers to his office and locked them in a file cabinet. Over the last month, he had meticulously cleaned out his desk and drawers and taken away everything of interest. And he'd said to her,
"Letty, if something happens to me, all the good stuff is in my office, locked up tight. The lawyers will deal with it, not my kids."
He'd also said,
"And I'm leaving a little something for you."
Chapter 5. By noon Monday, the entire Bar Association of Ford County was buzzing with the news of the suicide and, much more important, with the curiosity of which firm might be chosen to handle the probate. Most deaths caused similar ripples, a fatal car wreck more so for obvious reasons. However, a garden variety murder did not. Most murderers were of the lower classes and thus unable to fork over meaningful fees. When the day began, Jake had nothing. No murders, no car wrecks, and no promising wills to probate. By lunch, though, he was mentally spending some money. He could always find something to do across the street in the courthouse. The land records were on the second floor in a long, wide room with lined shelves of thick plat books dating back 200 years. In his younger days, when totally bored or hiding from Lucian, he spent hours poring over old deeds and grants as if some big deal was in the works. Now, though, at the age of 35 and with 10 years under his belt, he avoided the room when possible. He fancied himself a trial lawyer, not a title checker, a courtroom brawler, not some timid little lawyer content to live in the archives and push papers around a desk. Even so, and regardless of his dreams, there were times each year when Jake, along with every other lawyer in town, found it necessary to get lost for an hour or so in the county's records. The room was crowded. The more prosperous firms used paralegals to do the research, and there were several there, lugging the books back and forth and frowning at the pages. Jake spoke to a couple of lawyers who were doing the same. Football talk mainly, because no one wanted to get caught snooping for the dirt on Seth Hubbard. To kill time, he looked through the index of wills to see if any Hubbard of note had handed down land or assets to Seth, but found nothing in the past 20 years. He walked down the hall to the chancery clerk's office with the thought of perusing old divorce files, but other lawyers were sniffing around. He left the courthouse in search of a better source. It was no surprise that Seth Hubbard hated the lawyers in Clanton. Most litigants, divorce or otherwise, who ran afoul of Harry Rex Vonner were miserable for the rest of their lives and loathed everything about the legal profession. Seth wasn't the first to commit suicide. Harry Rex extracted blood, along with money and land and everything else in sight. Divorce was his specialty, and the uglier the better. He relished the dirt, the gutter fighting, the hand-to-hand combat, the thrill of the secret phone recording, or the surprise 8x10 snapshot of the girlfriend in her new convertible. His trials were trench warfare. His alimony settlements set records. For fun, he blew up uncontested divorces and turned them into 2-year death marches. He loved to sue ex-lovers for alienation of affection. If none of the dirty tricks in his bag worked, he invented more. With a near monopoly on the market, he controlled the docket and bullied the court clerks. Young lawyers ran from him, and old lawyers, already burned, kept their distance. He had few friends, and those who remained loyal often struggled to do so. Among lawyers, Harry Rex trusted only Jake, and the trust was mutual. During the Haley trial, when Jake was losing sleep and weight and focus and dodging bullets and death threats, and certain he was about to blow the biggest case of his career, Harry Rex quietly stepped into Jake's office. He stayed in the background, spending hours on the case without looking for a dime. He unloaded volumes of free advice and kept Jake sane. As always, on Mondays, Harry Rex was at his desk eating a hoagie for lunch. For divorce lawyers like him, Mondays were the worst days, as marriages cracked over the weekends and spouses already at war ramped up their attacks. Jake entered the building through a rear door to avoid, one, the notoriously prickly secretaries, and two, the smoke-laden waiting room filled with stressed-out clients. Harry Rex's office door was closed. Jake listened for a moment, heard no voices, then shoved it open.
"What do ye want?"
Harry Rex growled as he chomped on a mouthful. The hoagie was spread before him on wax paper, with a small mountain of barbecue potato chips piled around it. He was washing it all down with a bottle of Bud Light. "Well, good afternoon, Harry Rex. Sorry to barge in on your lunch." He wiped his mouth with the back of a beefy hand and said,
"You're not bothering my lunch. What's up?"
"Drinking already?" Jake said as he backed into a massive leather chair.
"If you had my clients, you'd start at breakfast."
"I thought you did."
"Never on Mondays. How's Miss Carla?"
"Fine, thanks. And how's Miss, what's her name?"
"Jane, smartass. Jane Ellen Vonner. And she's not only surviving life with me, but seems to be having a ball and thankful to be so lucky. Finally found a woman who understands me."
He scooped up a pile of bright red chips and crammed them in his mouth. "Congratulations.
When do I meet her?" "We've been married for 2 years."
I know, but I preferred to wait 5. No sense rushing in when these gals have such a short shelf life.
You come here to insult me?
Of course not. And Jake was being honest. Swapping insults with Harry Rex was a fool's game. He weighed over 300 pounds and lumbered around town like an old bear, but his tongue was stunningly quick and vicious. Jake said, "Tell me about Seth Hubbard." Harry Rex laughed and sent debris flying over his landfill of a desk.
"Couldn't have happened to a bigger asshole. Why do you ask me?"
"Ozzy said you handled one of his divorces."
"I did. His second. Maybe 10 years ago. About the time you showed up here in town and started calling yourself a lawyer. Why should Seth concern you?"
"Well, before he killed himself, he wrote me a letter. And he also wrote a 2-page will. Both arrived in the mail this morning." Harry Rex took a sip of beer, narrowed his eyes, and thought about this.
"You ever meet him?"
"Never."
"Lucky. You didn't miss a damn thing."
"Don't talk about my client like that."
"What'd the will say?"
"Can't tell you, and I can't probate until after the funeral."
"Who gets everything?"
"I can't say. I'll tell you on Wednesday."
A 2-page handwritten will prepared the day before the suicide. Sounds like a 5-year lawsuit bonanza to me.
"I sure hope so."
"That'll keep you busy for a while."
"I need the work. What's the old boy got?" Harry Rex shook his head while reaching for the hoagie.
"Don't know,"
he said, then took a bite. The clear majority of Jake's friends and acquaintances preferred not to speak with a mouthful of food. But such social graces had never slowed down Harry Rex.
"As I recall, and again it's been 10 years, he owned a house up there on Simpson Road with some acreage around it. The biggest asset was a sawmill and a lumber yard on Highway 21 near Palmyra. My client was Sybil Hubbard, wife number 2, and I think it was her second or third marriage."
After 20 years and countless cases, Harry Rex could still floor people with his recall. The juicier the details, the longer he remembered them. A quick chug of beer, then he continued.
"She was nice enough, not a bad-looking gal, and smart as hell. She worked in the lumber yard, ran the damn thing, really, and it was making good money when Seth decided to expand. He wanted to buy a lumber yard in Alabama, and he started spending time over there. Turns out, there was a secretary in the front office who had his attention. Everything blew up. Seth got caught with his pants down, and Sybil hired me to scorch his ass. Scorch I did. I convinced the court to order the sale of the sawmill and lumber yard near Palmyra. The other one never made money. Got $200,000 for the sale, all of which went to my client. They also had a nice little condo on the Gulf near Destin. Sybil got that too. That's a skinny version of what happened. But the file is a foot thick. You can go through it if you want."
"Maybe later." "No idea of what his current balance sheet looks like?"
"Nope. I lost track of the guy. He laid low after the divorce. The last time I talked to Sybil, she was living on the beach and having fun with another husband. A much younger man, she claimed. She said there were rumors that Seth was back in the timber and lumber business, but she didn't know much."
He swallowed hard and washed it all down. He burped loudly, without the slightest trace of hesitation or embarrassment, and continued,
"You talked to his kids?"
"Not yet. You know them?"
"I did at the time. They'll make your life interesting. Herschel is a real loser. His sister, what's her name?"
"Ramona Hubbard Defoe."
"That's the one. She's a few years younger than Herschel and part of that North Jackson crowd. Neither one got along well with Seth, and I always got the impression he wasn't much of a father. They really liked Sybil, their second mom, and once it became apparent Sybil would win the divorce and make off with the money, they fell into her camp. Let me guess. The old man left them nothing?"
Jake nodded, but didn't say a word.
"Then they'll freak out and lawyer up.
You got a good one brewing, Jake. Sorry I can't wedge in and get some of the fee.
If you only knew. A final bite of the hoagie, then the last of the chips. Harry Rex crushed the wrapper, the bag, the napkins, and tossed them somewhere under his desk, along with the empty beer bottle. He opened a drawer, withdrew a long black cigar, and jammed it into the side of his mouth, unlit. He'd stopped smoking them, but still went through 10 a day, chewing and spitting.
I heard he hung himself. That true?
It is. He did a good job of planning things.
Any idea why?
You've heard the rumors. He was dying of cancer. That's all we know. Who was his lawyer during the divorce?
He used Stanley Wade. A mistake.
Wade? Since when does he do divorces?
Not anymore,
Harry Rex said with a laugh. He smacked his lips and grew serious.
Look, Jake, hate to tell you this, but what happened 10 years ago is of no significance whatsoever in this matter. I took all of Seth Hubbard's money. Kept enough for myself, of course, gave the rest to my client, and closed the file. Whatever Seth did after divorce number 2 is none of my business.
He waved his hand across the landfill on his desk and said,
This, however, is what my Monday is all about. If you want to get a drink later, fine. But right now, I'm swamped.
A drink later with Harry Rex usually meant something after 9 p.m.
Sure, we'll catch up,
Jake said as he headed for the door, stepping over files.
Say, Jake, is it safe to assume Hubbard renounced a previous will?
Yes.
And was that previous will prepared by a firm somewhat larger than yours?
Yes.
Then if I were you, I'd race to the courthouse and file the first petition to probate.
My client wants me to wait until after the funeral.
When's that?
Tomorrow at 4.
The courthouse closes at 5. I'd be there. First is always better.
Thanks, Harry Rex.
Don't mention it.
He burped again and picked up a file. Traffic was steady throughout the afternoon as the neighbors and church members and other friends made the solemn trek to Seth's home to deliver food, to commiserate, but mainly to nail down the gossip that was raging through the northeastern edge of Ford County. Most were politely turned away by Letty, who manned the front door, took the casseroles and cakes, accepted condolences, and said time and again that the family was thankful but not taking company. Some, though, managed to step inside, into the den where they gawked at the furnishings and tried to absorb a piece of the life of their dear departed friend. They had never been there before, and Letty had never heard of these people. Yet they grieved. Such a tragic way to go. Did he really hang himself? The family was hiding on the rear patio, where they regrouped around a picnic table and kept themselves away from the traffic. Their search of Seth's desk and drawers revealed nothing of benefit. When quizzed, Letty claimed to know nothing, though they were doubtful. She answered their questions with soft, slow, thoughtful responses, and this made them even more suspicious. She served them lunch on the patio at 2 p.m., during a break in the visitation. They insisted on having a cloth on the picnic table and linens and silver, though Seth's collection had been badly neglected for many years. Unspoken were their feelings that, at $5 an hour, the least Letty could do was act like a real servant. As she buzzed about, she overheard them discussing who would attend the funeral and who would not. Ian, for example, was in the middle of rescuing an enormous deal that could, quite possibly, affect the financial future of the entire state. Important meetings were on tap tomorrow, and missing them might cause problems. Herschel and Ramona grudgingly accepted the reality that they could not avoid the service, though at times Letty thought they were jockeying for a way out. Ramona's health was fading by the hour, and she wasn't sure she could bear much more. Herschel's ex-wife would definitely not be there. He didn't want her there. She had never liked Seth, and he had despised her. Herschel had two daughters, one in college in Texas and the other in high school in Memphis. The co-ed could not miss any more classes, and Herschel admitted she really wasn't that close to her grandfather. No kidding, thought Letty, as she removed some more dishes. The younger daughter was doubtful, too. Seth had one brother, their Uncle Ansel, a man they had never met and knew nothing about. According to what scarce family lore existed, Ansel had lied about his age and joined the Navy at 16 or 17. He had been wounded in the Pacific, survived, then drifted around the world at various jobs in the shipping business. Seth lost contact with his younger brother decades earlier and never mentioned him. There was no way to contact Ansel, and clearly no reason to do so. He was probably as dead as Seth. They talked about some old family relatives, none of whom they'd seen in years, none of whom they wanted to see now. What a sad, curious family, Letty thought as she served them a selection of cakes. It was shaping up to be a small and quick funeral service.
"Let's get her out of here," Herschel said when Letty returned to the kitchen. "We're getting ripped off at $5 an hour."
"We? Since when are we paying her?" Ramona asked.
"Oh, she's on our clock now, one way or the other. Everything's coming out of the estate."
"I'm not cleaning the house, Herschel. Are you?"
"Of course not." Ian spoke up. "Let's play it cool. Get through the funeral and all. Tell her to clean the house, then we'll lock it up when we leave on Wednesday."
"Who tells her she's out of a job?" Ramona asked.
"I'll do it," Herschel said. "No big deal. She's just a maid." "There's something fishy about her," Ian said. "Can't put my finger on it, but she acts like she knows something we don't, something important. Y'all feel that way?" "Definitely something in the air," Herschel said, pleased to reach a rare agreement with his brother-in-law.
But Ramona disagreed. "No, it's just the shock and the sadness. She's one of the few people Seth could tolerate, or could tolerate him, and she's sad he's gone. That, and she's about to lose her job."
"You think she knows she's about to be fired?" Herschel asked.
"I'm sure she's worried."
"She's just a housekeeper."
Letty arrived home with a cake, one graciously given to her by Ramona. It was a flat, one-layer sheet cake coated with store-bought vanilla icing and laden with slices of toasted pineapple. Without a doubt, the least appealing of the half-dozen arranged on Mr. Hubbard's kitchen counter. It had been delivered by a man from the church who'd asked Letty, among other things, if the family planned to sell Seth's Chevrolet pickup truck. Letty had no idea, but promised to pass along the inquiry. She did not. She had seriously considered tossing the cake into a ditch along the route home, but couldn't bring herself to be so wasteful. Her mother was battling diabetes and did not need another load of sugar if she in fact wanted to sample the cake. Letty parked in the gravel drive and noted that Simeon's old truck was not there. She did not expect it since he had been away for several days. She preferred him to be away, but she never knew from one day to the next. It was not a happy house in good times, and her husband rarely made things better. The kids were still on the school bus somewhere, headed home. Letty entered through the kitchen and placed the cake on the table. As always, she found Cypress in the den, watching television for the umpteenth hour in a row. Cypress smiled and stretched her arms upward.
"My baby," she said, "how was your day?"
Letty leaned down and gave her a polite hug.
"Pretty busy. How was yours?"
"Just me and the shows," Cypress replied.
"How the Hubbards dealing with their loss, Letty? Please, sit down and talk to me."
Letty turned off the television, sat on the stool next to her mother's wheelchair, and talked about her day. Not a dull moment as Herschel and the Defoes arrived and walked through their childhood home with their father gone for the first time. Then the traffic, the neighbors and food, and the endless parade. Quite an exciting day altogether, as Letty spun things, careful to avoid any hint of trouble. Cypress's blood pressure was barely held in check by a collection of medications, and it could spike at the slightest hint of trouble. At some point, and soon, Letty would gently break the news that she was losing her job. But not now. There would be a better time later.
And the funeral?
Cypress asked, stroking her daughter's arm. Letty gave the details, said she planned to attend, and relished the fact that Mr. Hubbard insisted that blacks be allowed inside the church.
Probably make you sit on the back row,
Cypress said with a grin.
Probably so, but I'll be there. Wish I could go with you. So do I.
Because of her weight and lack of mobility, Cypress rarely left the house. She had been living there for 5 years and gaining weight and becoming less mobile by the month. Simeon stayed away for many reasons, not the least of which was Letty's mother. Letty said,
Mrs. Defoe sent us a cake. Would you like a small piece? What kind?
Though she weighed a ton, Cypress could be a picky eater.
Well, it's a pineapple something or other. Not sure I've seen it before. But it might be worth a try. Would you like some coffee with it? Yes, and just a small piece. Let's sit out back, Mama, and get some fresh air. I like that.
The wheelchair could barely squeeze between the sofa and the television, and it fit tightly in the narrow hallway into the kitchen. It rubbed alongside the table, inched through the rear door, and with Letty pushing gently, it rolled onto the sagging wooden deck Simeon had thrown together years earlier. When the weather was nice, Letty liked a late afternoon coffee or iced tea outside, away from the noise and stuffiness of the cramped house. There were too many people for a small house with only 3 tiny bedrooms. Cypress had one. Letty and Simeon, whenever he was home, shared another, usually with a grandchild or two. Their daughters somehow survived shoulder to shoulder in the 3rd bedroom. Clarice, age 16, was in high school and had no children. Phaedra, age 21, had a kindergartner, a 1st grader, and no husband. Their younger son, Kirk, 14, slept on the sofa in the den. It was not at all uncommon for nieces and nephews to stay a few months while their parents sorted things out. Cypress took a sip of instant coffee and picked at the cake with a fork. Slowly, she took a bite and chewed and frowned. Letty didn't like it either, so they drank their coffee and talked about the Hubbard family and how confused it was. They poked fun at white folks and their funerals and how they got in such a hurry to bury their dead, often within 2 or 3 days of death. Black folks took their time.
You seem distant, honey. What's on your mind?
Cypress asked softly. The kids would be home shortly from school, then Phaedra from work. This would be the last quiet moment until bedtime. Letty took a deep breath and said,
I heard them talking, Mama, and they're going to let me go. Probably this week, not long after the funeral.
Cypress shook her large, round head and looked ready to cry.
But ah, no need for a housekeeper, I guess. They'll sell the house because neither of them wants it. Heavens! They can't wait to get their hands on his money. They never had time to come see him, but now they're circling like buzzards. White people, do it every time. They think he paid me too much, so they're in a hurry to cut me off. How much he pay you? Now, Mama.
Letty had never told anyone in her family that Mr. Hubbard was paying $5 an hour and in cash. Such a wage was indeed on the high end for domestic help in rural Mississippi, and Letty knew better than to cause trouble. Her family might want a little extra. Her friends might talk. Keep secrets, Letty, Mr. Hubbard had told her. Never talk about your money. Simeon, sorry as he was, would lose all motivation to bring home anything. His earnings were as erratic as his presence, and he needed no prompting to earn even less. Letty said,
I heard him refer to me as a servant. A servant? Ain't heard that in a long time. They're not nice people, Mama. I doubt if Mr. Hubbard was a good father, but his kids are sorry. And now they get all his money. I suppose. They sure counting on it. How much he got?
Letty shook her head and took a sip of cold coffee.
I have no idea. Not sure anybody does.
Chapter 6. The parking lot of the Irish Road Christian Church was half full when Ozzie's relatively unmarked car turned into it at 5 minutes before four on Tuesday afternoon. There were no words or numbers painted boldly on the car. Ozzie preferred a lower profile, but one glance and you knew it was the High Sheriff. A collection of antennas, a small round blue light on the dash, partially hidden, a big brown Ford with four doors and black wheels, same as virtually every other High Sheriff in the state. He parked it next to the red Saab, which was parked away from the other cars. Ozzie got out as Jake was getting out, and together they crossed the parking lot. "Anything new?" Jake asked.
"Nothing," Ozzie said.
He was wearing a dark suit with black cowboy boots. Jake, the same, minus the boots.
"You?"
"Nothing. I guess the shit'll hit the fan tomorrow."
Ozzie laughed and said,
"I can't wait."
The church originally was a red brick chapel with a squatty steeple above a set of double front doors. Over time, though, the congregation had added the obligatory metal buildings, one beside the chapel that dwarfed it, and one behind it where the youth played basketball. On a small knoll nearby, there was a cemetery under shady trees, a quiet and pretty place to be buried. A few smokers were getting their last-minute drags, countrymen in old suits reluctantly worn. They were quick to speak to the sheriff. They nodded politely to Jake. Inside, there was a respectable crowd scattered throughout the dark-stained oak pews. The lights were low. An organist softly played a mournful dirge, priming the crowd for the sorrow to come. Seth's closed casket was draped in flowers and situated below the pulpit. His pallbearers sat grim-faced and shoulder to shoulder off to the left near the piano. Jake and Ozzie sat alone on a back row and began looking around. Grouped together not far away were some black folks, five in total. Ozzie nodded at them and whispered,
"Green dress, that's Letty Lang."
Jake nodded and whispered back,
"Who are the others?"
Ozzie shook his head.
"Can't tell from here."
Jake stared at the back of Letty's head and tried to imagine the adventures they were about to share. He had yet to meet this woman, had never heard her name until the day before, but they were about to become well acquainted. Letty sat unknowing, her hands folded in her lap. That morning she had worked for 3 hours before being asked by Herschel to leave. On her way out, he informed her that her employment would be terminated as of 3 p.m. Wednesday, the following day. At that point, the house would be locked up and deserted until further orders from the court. Letty had $400 in her checking account, one she kept away from Simeon, and she had $300 in a pickle jar hidden in the pantry. Beyond that, she was broke and had slim prospects for meaningful work. She had not spoken to her husband in almost 3 weeks. Occasionally, he would return home with a paycheck or some cash. Usually, though, he was just drunk and needed to sleep it off. Soon to be unemployed, with bills and people to feed, Letty could have sat there listening to the organ and fretted over her future. But she did not. Mr. Hubbard had promised her more than once that when he died, and he knew his death was imminent, he would leave a little something for her. How little or how much? Letty could only dream. Four rows behind her, Jake thought to himself, If she only knew. She had no idea he was there or why. She would later claim she recognized his name because of the Haley trial, but she had never actually seen Mr. Brigantz. In the center, on the road directly in front of the casket, Ramona Defoe sat with Ian to her left and Herschel to her right. None of their children, Seth's grandchildren, had been able to make the drive. Their lives were just too busy, not that their parents had pushed too hard. Behind them was a row of relatives so distant they had to introduce themselves in the parking lot, and their names were quickly forgotten. Seth Hubbard's parents had been dead for decades. His only sibling, Ansel, was long gone. There had never been much family to begin with, and the years had decimated the rest. Behind the family and throughout the dim sanctuary, there were several dozen other mourners, employees of Seth's, friends, fellow church members. When Pastor Don McElwain stepped to the pulpit precisely at 4 p.m., he and everyone else knew the service would be brief. He led them in prayer and recited a quick obituary. Seth was born May 10, 1917, in Ford County, where he died on October 2, 1988, preceded in death by parents so-and-so, two surviving children, some grandchildren, etc. Jake spotted a familiar profile several rows up and to his left, a man in a nice suit, same age, same law class. Stillman Rush, attorney at law, third-generation prick from a family of same, blue bloods from the big leagues of corporate and insurance law, or as big as they could possibly be in the rural South. Rush and Westerfield, the largest firm in North Mississippi, based in Tupelo, with offices coming soon to a shopping center near you. Seth Hubbard mentioned the Rush firm in his letter to Jake, and also in his handwritten will, so there was little doubt Stillman Rush and the other two well-dressed gentlemen with him had come to check on their investment. Typically, the insurance boys worked in pairs. It took two to perform even the most mundane legal tasks. Two to file papers in court, two to answer a docket call, two for an uncontested hearing, two to drive here and there, and of course two to jack up the billing and pad the file. Big law firms vigorously worshipped inefficiencies. More hours meant more fees. But three? For a quick funeral out in the boonies? This was impressive and exciting. It meant money. There was no doubt in Jake's hyperactive mind that the three had turned on their meters when they'd left their offices in Tupelo and were now sitting over there pretending to mourn at $200 an hour per man. According to Seth's final words, a Mr. Lewis McGuire had drafted a will in September of 1987, and Jake figured he was one of the three. Jake did not know McGuire, but then the firm had so many lawyers. Since they prepared the will, they naturally assumed they would probate it. Tomorrow, he thought, they'll drive over again, at least two, but maybe another trio, and they'll take their paperwork to the offices of the Chancery Court clerk on the second floor of Jake's courthouse, and they'll smugly inform either Eva or Sarah that they have arrived for the purposes of opening the estate of Mr. Seth Hubbard for probate. And either Eva or Sarah will suppress a grin while appearing confused. Papers will be shuffled, questions asked, then a big surprise. You're a bit late, sirs. That estate has already been opened. Either Eva or Sarah will show them to the new filings, where they will gawk at the thin, handwritten will, one that specifically revoked and denounced the thick one they so cherished. And the war will begin. They will curse Jake Brigantz, but once they settle down, they will realize that the war could be profitable for all the lawyers. Letty wiped a tear and realized she was probably the only person crying. In front of the lawyers were some business types, one of whom turned around and whispered something to Stillman Rush. Jake thought this might be one of the higher-ups who worked for Seth. He was particularly curious about Mr. Russell Amberg, described in the handwritten will as once the vice president of Seth's holding company and the man with the knowledge of the assets and liabilities. Mrs. Nora Baines sang three stanzas of the Old Rugged Cross, a somber, surefire tearjerker at any funeral. But at Seth's, it failed to provoke emotion. Pastor McElwain read from Psalms and dwelled on the wisdom of Solomon. Then two teenage boys with pimples and a guitar strummed and hummed through something contemporary, a strained song Seth would not have appreciated. Ramona finally broke down and was comforted by Ian. Herschel just stared at the floor in front of the casket, never blinking, never moving. Another woman sobbed loudly in response. Seth's cruel plan was to withhold knowledge of his last will until after the funeral. In his letter to Jake, his exact words were, "Do not mention my last will and testament until after the funeral. I want my family to be forced to go through all the rituals of mourning before they realize they get nothing. Watch them fake it. They're very good at it. They have no love for me." As the service dragged on, it became apparent that there was little faking going on. What was left of his family didn't care enough to even fake it. What a sad way to go, thought Jake. At Seth's instructions, there were no eulogies. No one spoke but the pastor, though it was easy to get the impression there might be no volunteers if they opened up the mic. The pastor finished with a marathon of a prayer, one obviously designed to burn some clock. 25 minutes after he started, he dismissed them with the invitation to walk next door to the cemetery for the interment. Outside, Jake managed to dodge Stillman Rush and the lawyers. Instead, he bumped into the nearest man in a business suit and said, "Excuse me, but I'm looking for a Russell Amberg." The man politely pointed and said, "Right there." Russell Amberg was standing 10 feet away, lighting a cigarette, and he heard Jake's inquiry. The two shook hands grimly and gave their names. Jake said, "Could I have a moment alone?" Mr. Amberg half shrugged and said softly,
"Sure. What's up?"
The crowd was drifting slowly in the general direction of the cemetery. Jake had no plans to watch the burial. He was on another mission. When he and Amberg were far enough away not to be heard, he said, "I'm a lawyer in Clanton. Never met Mr. Hubbard, but I received a letter from him yesterday. A letter along with his last will and testament, in which he names you as his executor. It is imperative that we talk as soon as possible." Amberg stopped cold and jammed the cigarette into a corner of his mouth. He glared at Jake, then glanced around to make sure they were alone.
"What kind of will?"
he said, exhaling smoke. "Handwritten, last Saturday." He was clearly contemplating his death.
"Then he was probably out of his mind," Amberg said, sneering, the first rattle of a saber in the coming war.
Jake had not expected this.
"We'll see. I guess that will be determined later. I was a lawyer once, Mr. Brigance. A long time ago, before I found honest work. I know the game."
Jake kicked a rock and looked around. The first mourners were nearing the front entrance of the cemetery. "Can we talk?"
"What's in the will?"
"I can't tell you now, but I can tell you tomorrow." Amberg cocked his head back and glared down along his nose.
"How much do you know about Seth's business?"
"Let's say nothing. In his will, he writes that you have a good knowledge of his assets and liabilities." Another draw, another sneer.
"There are no liabilities, Mr. Brigance. Only assets, and plenty."
"Please, let's meet and have a chat. All secrets are about to be revealed, Mr. Amberg. I just need to know where it's going. Under the terms of his will, you're the executor and I'm the lawyer for the estate.
That doesn't sound right. Seth hated lawyers in Clanton.
Yes, he made that very clear. If we can meet in the morning, I'll be happy to show you a copy of his will and shed some light. Amberg started walking again, and Jake tagged along, for a few steps anyway. As they approached the cemetery, Ozzie was waiting by the gate. Amberg stopped again and said,
I live in Temple. There's a cafe on Highway 52 west of town. Meet me there at 7:30 in the morning.
Okay. What's the name of the cafe?
The Cafe. Got it.
Amberg disappeared without another word. Jake looked at Ozzie, shook his head in disbelief, then pointed to the parking lot. Both of them eased away from the cemetery. They'd had enough of Seth Hubbard for one day. Their farewell was complete. 20 minutes later, at exactly 4:55 p.m., Jake jogged into the offices of the Chancery Court clerk and smiled at Sarah.
Where you been?
She snapped, waiting. It's not even 5 o'clock, he shot back as he zipped open his briefcase.
Yes, but we stop working at 4 on Tuesdays anyway. 5 on Monday, 3 on Wednesday and Thursday. On Friday, you lucky if we show up.
The woman talked nonstop and had a quick tongue. After 20 years of daily give and take with a bunch of lawyers, she had honed her retorts and one-liners. Jake laid the papers on the counter in front of her and said, I need to open the estate of Mr. Seth Hubbard.
Testate or intestate?
Oh, he has a will. More than one. That's where the fund's coming from.
Didn't he just kill himself?
You know damn well he just killed himself because you work in this courthouse where rumors fly and gossip is created and nothing is secret.
I'm offended,
she said, stamping the petition. She flipped a few pages, smiled, and said,
Ooh, nice. A handwritten will. A boon to the legal profession.
You got it.
Who gets everything?
My lips are sealed. As Jake bantered, he pulled more papers from his briefcase.
Well, Mr. Brigance, your lips may be sealed, but this court file certainly is not.
She stamped something dramatically and said,
It is now officially a public record under the laws of this great state, unless, of course, you have a written motion requesting the file to be sealed.
I do not.
Oh, good. So we can talk about all the dirt? There is some dirt, right?
Don't know. I'm still digging. Look, Sarah, I need a favor.
Anything you want, baby.
This is a race to the courthouse, and I've just won. Sometime soon, perhaps tomorrow, I expect 2 or 3 pompous-ass lawyers in dark suits to show up and hand over their version of a petition to open Mr. Hubbard's estate. More than likely, they'll be from Tupelo. There's another will, you see.
I love it.
So do I. Anyway, you're not required to inform them they've just finished second, but it might be fun to watch their faces. What do you think?
I can't wait.
Great. Show them the court file, have a laugh, then call me with a full report. But please, bury this until tomorrow.
You got it, Jake. This could be fun.
Well, if things unfold the way I expect, this case could keep us amused for the next year. As soon as he left, Sarah read the handwritten will that was attached to Jake's petition. She summoned the other clerks to her desk, where they read it, too. A black lady from Clanton said she'd never heard of Letty Lang. No one seemed to know Seth Hubbard. They chatted a while, but it was now after 5 p.m., and everyone had places to go. The file was put in its place, the lights were turned off, and the clerks quickly forgot things related to work. They would resume their speculation the following day and get to the bottom of the matter. Had the petition and will been filed during the morning, the entire courthouse would have been buzzing by noon, the entire town by late afternoon. Now, though, the gossip would have to wait. But not for long. Simeon Lang was drinking, but he was not drunk. a distinction that was often blurred but generally understood by his family. Drinking meant behavior that was somewhat controlled and not threatening. It meant he was slowly sipping beer with glassy eyes and a thick tongue. Being drunk meant harrowing times, with people running from the house and hiding in the trees. And, to his credit, he was often cold sober, the preferred state, even for Simeon. After 3 weeks on the road hauling loads of scrap iron throughout the Deep South, he had returned with a paycheck intact, tired and clear-eyed. He offered no explanation of where he had been. He never did. He tried to appear content, even domesticated, but after a few hours of bumping into other people and of listening to Cypress and of deflecting the rejections of his wife, he ate a sandwich and moved outdoors with his beer to a spot under a tree beside the house where he could sit in peace and watch the occasional car go by. Returning was always a struggle. Out there on the open road, he would dream for hours of a new life somewhere, always a better life, alone and unbothered. He'd been tempted 1,000 times to keep driving, to drop his freight at its destination and never slow down. His father left them when he was a kid, left a pregnant wife and 4 children, and was never heard from. For days, Simeon and his older brother sat on the porch, hiding tears, waiting. As he grew, he hated his father, still did. But now he too was feeling the urge to run away. His kids were much older. They would survive. On the road, he often asked himself why he felt the pull of home. He hated living in a cramped rental house with his mother-in-law, 2 rotten grandkids he didn't ask for, and a wife who nagged him for more out of life. Letty had threatened divorce 100 times in the past 20 years, and to him it was a miracle they were together. "You want a split? Then let's have a split," he said as he took a sip. But he'd said that 100 times too. It was almost dark when she stepped out of the house onto the rear patio and slowly made her way across the grass to his tree. He sat in 1 of 2 mismatched lawn chairs, his feet propped on an old milk crate, his beer cooler next to him. He offered her the other chair, but she declined.
"How long you home?"
she asked softly as she stared at the road like him.
"I just got home, and you ready for me to leave?"
"I didn't mean it that way, Simeon. Just curious, that's all."
He wasn't about to answer the question, so he took another sip. They were rarely alone together, and when they were, they couldn't remember how to talk. A car passed slowly on the county road, and they watched it as though fascinated. Finally, she said,
"I'm probably going to lose my job tomorrow. I told you Mr. Hubbard killed himself, and his family don't want me around past tomorrow."
Simeon had mixed feelings about this. It made him feel superior because, once again, he would be the principal breadwinner, the head of the house. He despised the way Letty took on airs when she was earning more than he was. He resented her bitching and chirping when he was out of work. Even though she was only a housekeeper, she could get arrogant when acting like a white man trusted her so thoroughly. But the family needed the money, and losing her wages would inevitably lead to trouble. He struggled to say,
"I'm sorry."
There was another long, silent gap. They could hear voices and noise from inside the house.
"Any word from Marvis?" he asked.
She dropped her head and said,
"No, it's been 2 weeks and no letter."
"Did you write him?"
"I write him every week, Simeon. You know that. When's the last time you wrote him?"
Simeon seethed but held his fire. He was proud of himself for coming home sober, and he wouldn't ruin it with a fight. Marvis Lang, age 28, 2 years in the pen, with at least 10 to go. Drug trafficking, assault with a deadly weapon. A car approached and slowed, then slowed some more, as if the driver wasn't sure. It moved a few feet, then turned into their driveway. There was enough sunlight left to reveal it to be an odd make, definitely foreign, and red in color. The engine was turned off, and a young white man got out, alone. He was wearing a white shirt with a loosened tie. He carried nothing, and after walking a few feet, seemed uncertain of where he was. "Over here," Simeon called out, and the young man stiffened as if scared. He had not seen them under the tree. He proceeded cautiously across the small front yard. "Looking for Miss Letty Lang," he said loud enough for them to hear.
"I'm over here,"
she said, as he came into view. He walked to within 10 feet and said, "Hello, my name is Jake Brigance. I'm a lawyer in Clanton, and I need to speak to Letty Lang."
"You were at the funeral today," she said.
"I was, yes." Simeon reluctantly climbed to his feet, and the three exchanged awkward handshakes. Simeon offered him a beer, then returned to his seat. Jake declined the beer, though he would have enjoyed one. He was, after all, there on business. Letty said, without being edgy,
"I'm sure you're not just passing through our little corner of the world."
"No, no, I'm not."
"Brigance," Simeon said, sipping, "didn't you represent Carl Lee Haley?"
"Ah, the old icebreaker, at least with black folks." "I did," Jake said modestly.
"I thought so. Good job. Great job."
"Thanks. Look, I'm actually here on business and, well, I need to speak with Letty here in private. No offense or anything, but I have to tell her something confidential."
"What is it?" she asked, confused. "Why is it private?" Simeon asked.
"Because the law says it is," Jake replied, fudging a bit. The law had nothing to do with this situation. In fact, as he muddled through this encounter, he began to realize that his big news, perhaps, wasn't so confidential after all. There was no doubt Letty would tell her husband everything before Jake pulled out of the driveway. The last will and testament of Seth Hubbard was now a public record and would be scrutinized by every lawyer in town within 24 hours. Where was the privacy, the confidentiality? Simeon angrily tossed a beer can against the tree, sending a line of foam across the trunk. He bolted to his feet, growling,
"All right, all right,"
as he kicked the milk crate. He reached into the cooler, grabbed another beer, and stomped away, mumbling and cursing under his breath. The shadows consumed him as he moved deeper into the trees, no doubt watching and listening.